Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Alice Bryant, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will have the final part of our story on Abraham Lincoln in our series, America's Presidents. But first, here is John Russell.
In Lebanon's Bica Valley, a nonprofit organization stores and grows seeds. The organization used to operate a research center just outside of Aleppo, Syria. But violence in Syria led the group to leave the country. Now, many employees hope their efforts will help rebuild the country they left behind. The organization is named the International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas, or ICARDA. ICARDA hopes to produce crops to help feed people around the world. When it was in Aleppo, the seed bank was spread across 1,000 hectares. It had 150,000 seed samples stored and ready to be grown. Each sample could hold traits that could help crops survive changing weather conditions. We try to figure out how to produce crops better adapted to climate change, says Ali Shaheda, a researcher for ICARDA. But the group's work was limited by violence during Syria's civil war. Ali Shaheda explains.
It started when they started stealing the cars from the centers and or even from blocking the roads, capturing the car, the people, stealing the car by forces. It just wasn't a pleasant experience for a lot of us.
In 2012, the ICARDA team copied most of the samples and sent them to Svalbard. Svalbard is a global seed vault dug into a mountain in northern Norway. In 2015, ICARDA took the seeds from Svalbard to help build collections in Lebanon and Morocco. An area called Tirbil in the Bica Valley is the new home for ICARDA. The new site has laboratories and a seed bank. Mariana Yazbek is a seed bank manager at the new site. She says the work of the bank will become more important as the climate continues to change.
You will need to make new crops, new varieties that can withstand very high temperature, that can produce yield even with less rainfall.
In fact, some analysts say climate change may have contributed to the conflict in Syria. The Levant region, which includes Syria, began suffering from a drought in 1998. It continued through the start of the war in Syria in 2011. A study published in the Journal of Geophysical Research says this drought is likely to be the worst in almost 900 years. The drought caused widespread change and challenges. Those factors, along with other issues in Syria, put pressure on the country's economy, government, and population. Since it began, the war has also hurt Syria's agricultural sector. According to a UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, study last year, the war has done $16 billion in damage. Adam Yao is an FAO representative. To rebuild the agricultural sector, there will need to be a major rethink of Syria's whole agricultural policy. He added that IKARTA's experts could have an important role in helping the country. Although no one is currently at the site, the IKARTA Center in Aleppo may still be working. Some 150,000 seeds are still thought to be frozen there, waiting for the researchers to return. I'm John Russell.
The government in Nigeria recently negotiated the release of 82 young women. All 82 were students 3 years ago when Boko Haram militants raided their school in the northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok. The militants kidnapped 276 schoolgirls in all. Today, Nigeria's Ministry of Women Affairs is caring for a total of 106 freed Chibok girls in the capital, Abuja. Boko Haram released most of them during a prisoner exchange last month. Others were freed in October after negotiations. Three of the girls escaped. The ministry is providing skills training and educational classes to the young women. They are also receiving psychosocial support. Women Affairs Minister Aisha Jumai Al-Hassan spoke about the young women at a recent event in Abuja. She said the government hopes they can return to school, possibly in September. They are going back to school because they had aspirations, said Al-Hassan. That was why their parents put them in school from where they were abducted. When they stabilize and when they recover, we will still put them back to school. The government said the Chibok girls will not return to their former school. The girls' families and some activists have criticized the decision. But the government says it is protecting the young women. Officials are also closely watching the girls' progress as they take part in recreational activities and weekly religious programs. They are also taking classes in biology, English, and mathematics. The girls are expected to be in the rehabilitation program for 9 months. Alan Manasseh is a member of the Bring Back Our Girls group. He spoke with some of the young women at their rehabilitation center. Wherever they are, the fact that they are not with the terrorists is considered okay for them, he said. Manasseh told VOA the women are healthy. But more than 100 other Chibok schoolgirls are still missing. That number includes two of his cousins. Foreign governments and aid groups are helping the former kidnap victims. The Canadian government recently gave healthcare products and clothing to the girls. They smiled when they were given the items, but they did not make any statements. Christopher Thornley is the Canadian High Commissioner to Nigeria.
The Chibok girls are symbolic of a vast humanitarian challenge affecting millions of lives. This is why Canada has stepped up this year to provide $27 million to UN agencies and NGO partners for humanitarian assistance in the Northeast. This includes $2 million that we have provided to UNFPA to support the Chibok girls as well as its interventions in the Northeast.
The raid on Chibok by Boko Haram was the largest and most famous kidnapping in the group's history. The Nigerian government says it continues to negotiate with Boko Haram to gain the release of the missing schoolgirls. I'm Alice Bryant.
Scientists have found new evidence that Homo sapiens, or humans, have been around longer than we thought. Bones found at a site called Jebel Erud in Morocco are 300,000 years old. That is about 100,000 years older than any other known remains of our species. They were discovered far from where the oldest fossils had been found before, in Ethiopia. Scientists decided that skulls, limb bones, and teeth they found represent at least five individuals. They show people from an early stage of our species' development. They are a mix of modern and more ancient or simpler humans. Jean-Jacques Hublin works at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, and the College of France in Paris. He and others describe the new findings in two papers released last week by the journal Nature. "They are not just like us," said Hublin, "but they had basically the face you could meet on the train in New York. While their face and teeth might look like today's humans, these fossils show a different shaped brain. They're brain cases. The part of the skull that contains the brain were longer. That means it took time for our brains to evolve to their present form. Given their modern-looking face and teeth," Hublin said, "these people may have blended in today if they wore a hat." Hublin said that, along with other evidence, the Moroccan fossils suggest that humans may have reached their modern-day form in more than one place within Africa. The Moroccan fossils were found between 2007 and 2011 in what was a cave setting. They represent three adults, one adolescent, and one child about 8 years old. It was thought that they lived a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, meaning they hunted or gathered their food instead of farming. They were found alongside bones of animals they hunted, gazelles and zebras. There were also stone tools possibly used as spearheads for hunting and knives. The tools were made from flint, a kind of stone, from about 40 kilometers away. Researchers also found evidence of much fire use. Today, Homo sapiens are the only human species. But 300,000 years ago, they would have lived on Earth with several now extinct relatives in Eurasia. I'm Anne Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we will finish our story about Abraham Lincoln. He led the United States during the Civil War. That conflict lasted from 1861 to 1865. In it, the southern states of the Confederacy battled the northern states of the Union. As a wartime president, Lincoln was known for several things. He was actively involved in plotting the military campaign. When Lincoln was unhappy with the performance of his top generals, he dismissed them. He also greatly increased the power of the presidency, even beyond what the U.S. Constitution permitted. And Lincoln struck at the issue at the heart of the Civil War, slavery. He ordered that enslaved people in the Confederate States be forever free. His order is called the Emancipation Proclamation. Seven months after the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect, the Confederacy and the Union clashed in the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. The army of Confederate General Robert E. Lee was on the offensive. Lee planned to move the fighting out of the South and invade the North. He won a major victory against Union forces at Chancellorsville, Virginia. Then he pushed across Maryland and into Pennsylvania. A Union army, led by General George Meade, met Lee's troops near a small crossroads town called Gettysburg. In the first days of July 1863, a little more than 2 years after the start of the Civil War, Confederate and Union troops each struggled to claim the territory. Both sides suffered massive casualties. But Lee believed Confederate troops were close to winning and that Meade had spread his soldiers thin. So, on the third day of fighting, he ordered a direct attack on Union forces. Lee's soldiers aimed at the center of the Union line, positioned behind stone walls at the top of a ridge, or raised area. Confederates first used cannons to fire artillery at the ridge. Then about 15,000 Confederate soldiers began marching across more than a kilometer of an open field. The Union soldiers behind the walls fired on them. More Union forces attacked the Confederate soldiers on the left and right. In half an hour, three-quarters of the soldiers in the open field had been killed or wounded. Thousands more on each side also died. The surviving Confederate forces quickly withdrew and waited for Meade to attack again. But, much to Lincoln's dissatisfaction, he did not. The following morning, Lee led the survivors back to Virginia. He left behind 28,000 soldiers dead, wounded, or missing, more than one-third of his total army. The Union had suffered 23,000 casualties, almost as many. The Battle of Gettysburg is important in American history for several reasons. One is the large number of killed and wounded soldiers, the largest until World War II in the 20th century. Another reason is because it was a turning point in the war. It ended Lee's invasion of the North and weakened his army permanently. Over the same days, Union troops won another major victory under General Ulysses S. Grant in the southern city of Vicksburg, Mississippi. The battles at Vicksburg and Gettysburg began to turn the conflict to the Union's favor. Finally, the Battle of Gettysburg is almost always linked to a speech Lincoln gave there, known as the Gettysburg Address. It is only about 270 words long, but it is one of the most famous speeches in American history. Lincoln spoke at the opening of a cemetery for all the soldiers who had died at Gettysburg. But he also used the event to speak to the entire country about the war. He said, "The conflict was a test of whether the American form of government could survive, that is, a government of the people, by the people, for the people." He also pointed to the Declaration of Independence as the country's founding document. He said, "The nation had been conceived in liberty," and, he said, "it was dedicated to the idea that all men are created equal." Historians have noted that, in the speech, Lincoln changed the reasoning behind the war effort. It continued to be a struggle to reunite the country. But after the Gettysburg Address, it was also more clearly a struggle to free enslaved people. In 1864, Lincoln won re-election to a second term as president. His new vice president was Senator Andrew Johnson from the southern state of Tennessee. At the swearing-in ceremony, the president spoke about the need for the North and South to come together again peacefully. In that speech, his famous second inaugural, Lincoln called on all Americans to finish the war. He urged them to care for the wounded, the wives and children of soldiers killed in battle, and to seek a just and lasting peace. Most importantly, Lincoln asked Americans to reunite with malice toward none, with charity for all. In other words, with respect and kindness. A few weeks later, the war effectively ended. Lincoln's military plan had worked. He had finally found two generals whom he trusted, Ulysses S. Grant and William T. Sherman. Sherman led a campaign across the southern states. His path through Georgia, from the city of Atlanta to the city of Savannah, was known as Sherman's March to the Sea. The march destroyed farms and houses along the way. The destruction was terrible. It was also effective. The Confederate Army was left with little food or communication. At the same time, Grant surrounded Lee's army in Virginia. Grant cut these Southern troops off from supplies, too. Lee realized he must surrender to Grant, although, he said, he would rather die 1,000 deaths. The two men met on April 9, 1865, at a farmhouse in the town of Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. Lee famously wore his finest military uniform and sword. Grant famously wore his fighting clothes, still marked with mud. Lee and Grant spoke briefly. Then Grant wrote the terms of surrender. As Lincoln had asked, the terms were respectful and generous. Lee's officers were free to keep their horses and their weapons, and the Union Army would give the Confederate soldiers food. When some Union troops began to play a victory song, Grant told them to stop. "The war is over," he said. "The rebels are our countrymen again." Five days after Lee surrendered, Lincoln and his wife, Mary, went to a theater in Washington, D.C. To put it mildly, the last years had been very difficult for them. While Lincoln was supervising the war effort, both his third and fourth son became sick with typhoid. The younger boy recovered. The older did not. Willie Lincoln died in the White House at age 11. Mary and Abraham Lincoln were crushed. Mary Lincoln blamed herself. She believed God was punishing her. In their own ways, the Lincolns continued to mourn in the years after Willie's death. At one point, Lincoln said he hoped he and Mary could feel happier. He urged them to have some pleasant times together. So, with the war coming to an end, they went to a light-hearted play at Ford's Theater. It was the night of Friday, April 14th, 1865, a day that Christians were marking that year as Good Friday, the anniversary of Jesus' death. The theater was not far from the White House. The Lincolns had seats in a box high above the stage. Toward the end of the performance, a man entered their box and shot Abraham Lincoln in the back of the head. Then the gunman jumped to the stage, breaking his leg as he landed. He called out a Latin expression, "Sic semper tyrannis." It means, "thus always to tyrants." Some observers say, the man added, "the South is avenged." The gunman was a Southerner named John Wilkes Booth. He had plotted to kill the president after hearing Lincoln support voting rights for African Americans. Booth briefly escaped, but was later captured and hanged. Lincoln was taken to a nearby boarding house. He seemed lifeless and could hardly breathe. Doctors examined him, but found they could not save him. Lincoln died the following morning. He was 56 years old. The emotions of many Americans changed from joy at the coming end of the Civil War to shock and mourning. Thousands lined up along railroad tracks as Lincoln's body made its way from Washington, D.C. to his home in Illinois. Even many Southerners mourned Lincoln's death. They understood that he would treat them kindly. A little more than 6 weeks after Lincoln's assassination, the last Confederate army surrendered, and the war was considered officially over. The country was reunited, and the process of legally freeing enslaved people had begun. Although these acts are tremendous parts of Lincoln's legacy, in time his public image would grow only larger and more celebrated. As one witness to Lincoln's death reportedly said, "Now he belongs to the ages." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.